Kia ora tātou. It's my pleasure to be able to speak to you today as part of the History and Historical Research Unit public seminar and lecture series on a topic that's dear to my heart and which I've just completed an article about, which is entitled China on a Plate, a Willow Pattern Garden Realized. One of chinoiserie's defining characteristics, observes David Porter, is its boundless adaptability, its repudiation of any fixed standard or accepted model. Those qualities are evident in the story of the development of Hawera's Willow Pattern Garden in 1960s New Zealand. Opened by the Republic of China ambassador to New Zealand in 1968, the story of this garden affords a curious and fascinating example of the multiple meanings chinoiserie elicited, not least the ongoing attraction of the Willow Pattern Plate, and inspiring everything from musical productions, plays and poetry, to diplomatic put-downs, critiques of colonialism, and the pattern's three-dimensional representation in garden form. What can chinoiserie, this talk asks, reveal as a repository of creative encounter in New Zealand? But first to 1960s Taranaki. On a rather blustery Saturday in early spring 1968, dancers wearing the national costumes of Greece, the Ukraine, Holland and Scotland gathered at Hawera's King Edward Park to welcome His Excellency, Mr. Consun Shah. Even if for only an afternoon, such a colourful and lively start to the weekend belied the stereotype of Hawera, and New Zealand for that matter, in this period, as a sleepy backwater. As a country service town, 1960s Hawera sat like an urban island of low-rise colonial bungalows amidst a sea of pea-green pastureland on the gentle but much-contested seaward-sloping Waimate Plains. No doubt unaware of Taranaki's turbulent and still troubled history, in his talk, before a crowd of several hundred, the ambassador drew affinities between the design principles of Hawera's Willow Pattern Garden and the private gardens of southern China. Both, he said, had their origins in cities. Both, he noted, embodied in their designs the concepts of concealment and contrast necessary to give an illusion of great space to a small urban setting. Because of the size of China, explained Shah, its people had come to enjoy small gardens in their cities. Whether large or small, the aim of a willow pattern garden was to puzzle visitors by the intricacy of design and layout. As I will show, the willow pattern design was one born of a creative response to the very foreignness of China, including its gardens, that the sometimes jarring and stimulating encounters with other cultures can produce. In this case, the encounter with China in the 18th century. But Shah's talk ranged beyond the topic of garden design. While the Chinese had become accustomed to living with and enjoying small gardens in tranquility, he declared, by sharp contrast those in Red China, by which he meant the People's Republic of China, were unable to do this without the constant interruption of soldiers or the playing of martial music. Cold War tensions were running high at the time of Shah's visit. China had embarked on the disastrous Great Proletarian Revolution in 1966, an ill-advised mass movement that was marked by iconic attacks on its own traditional culture and people. China was also adopting a more bellicose public face, having in 1964 joined the questionable ranks of the Atomic Club. An escalation of US involvement in Vietnam under LBJ's administration further heightened regional tensions. Willow pattern wear, then, as international diplomacy? To understand the garden's development and the cultural pull of the willow pattern design, indeed, just how and why a fanciful design on a plate not only came to be built in three dimensions, but also could embody simmering Cold War tensions, we must look to the history of the introduction of the design into Britain and thence New Zealand. Chinese gardens were a ubiquitous presence in the 19th and 20th century British world. From Winnipeg to Wellington, from Bombay to Ballarat, before governors and governesses, Māori chiefs and missionaries, Chinese gardens appeared at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. As a clockwork regularity of culinary colonial chinoiserie, the blue and white ware tea and dinner services presented a fancifully flimsy chinoiserie fantasy world, as David Porter has noted, of doll-like lovers, children, monkeys, and fishermen lolling about in gardens embraced by eternal spring. Yet willow pattern ware and its distinctive depiction of a blue Chinese garden scene on white background became, as David Porter has noted, paradigmatic emblems of Englishness. As he continues, 18th century consumers in England were infatuated with Chinese and Chinese-style goods, even as they were amused, perplexed, or troubled by the alien aesthetic sensibility these goods embodied. That visual style was, of course, not just limited to England. Chinoiserie came to denote the European manifestation of various styles with which a mixed Rococo, Baroque, Gothic, or any other European style it was felt was suitable. Objects of chinoiserie designs represented, as Oliver Impey writes, the European idea of what Oriental things were like, or ought to be like. Perhaps chinoiserie's most famous manifestation was blue and white ware. For world historian Robert Finlay, blue and white ware is the world's first global style, a collective visual language in ceramic art. The style developed under the Mongol peace of the 13th and 14th centuries. Muslim merchants in Qianzhou, China, took advantage of technical improvements to Chinese porcelain to enable decorative designs in blue to be painted on highly lustrous porcelain. The city, by the way, is located in Fujian province. In short, technical improvements enabled the production of artistic designs that proved irresistible and highly profitable trade goods. Ships from the Middle East would bring cobalt oxide, known in Chinese by one of its names as Muslim blue. They would bring this over 6,000 kilometers to China in return for customized wares manufactured in bulk in China for Islamic markets. As a trade, it was, as Finlay notes, unprecedented in world history. Blue and white ware was eventually exported throughout Southeast Asia and Africa along Indian Ocean trade networks. Relatively little Chinese porcelain reached Northern Europe until the 17th century, whereupon the floodgates opened, thanks initially to the efforts of the Dutch East India Company. Over a 200-year period from 1700, the Dutch imported about 43 million pieces of porcelain, other countries' companies at least 30 million. European manufacturers subsequently began to produce cheap import substitutes in an attempt to cash in on the mania for Chinese objects. The development of the willow pattern ware design, then, must be understood as a particular manifestation of a complex global style. Willow pattern itself was a design fantasy around the 1780s of one Thomas Minton, an apprentice engineer. Its full denouement came somewhat later, after Minton moved to work for Josiah Spode, an innovator who pioneered the use of underglazed transfer painting and who later perfected the recipe for finer quality bone china. Around 1790, Spode's pottery manufactory in Stoke produced the first pieces combining the elements that subsequently became known as willow pattern. Its signal features came to include a willow tree in the central position, three figures crossing a bridge, heading away from the main building, a zigzagging fence stretching across the foreground, and two birds hovering in the top centre. By 1814, such was the popularity and cheapness of the design that many other manufacturers began copying it. The appeal lay not just in its attractive design, but in the classic tale of two star-crossed lovers associated with it. While there are several variations, the basic plot is something like this. A loyal bookkeeper, Chang, works for a powerful yet corrupt customs official whose years of graft are about to be exposed. The Mandarin resigns, so does Chang, who loyally destroys his master's account books, only to be summarily dismissed. Meanwhile, Chang and the Mandarin's daughter, Kongzi, have fallen in love, meeting secretly under fruit trees, enraged upon hearing this, for he has plans to marry his daughter to a wealthy and elderly duke. The mandarin banishes Chang from the house. But, through a ruse, Chang returns to elope with his lover on a junk, taking some of the mandarin's treasures with him too. The willow pattern weir depicts the chase scene through the three figures on a bridge and their escape on a junk. The two lovers live in a house built by Chang, their dwelling depicted in the top left in the willow pattern weir, as you'll see here. Soon, however, with all of the jewellery pawned off, Chang is forced to find a living through other means. He writes a book on gardens, which earns him a growing reputation, but also, unfortunately, the attention of the mandarin. The mandarin, still seething from Chang's deceit and the loss of his daughter, orders soldiers to find his daughter and avenge her elopement. The soldiers kill Chang, while, in most stories at least, there are several versions of it, Kongxi also dies, either at her own hand or the soldiers. The gods, however, pity them, and the two lovers are turned into turtle doves, which are depicted at the top centre of the plate. For years it was assumed the story came from China, yet of course it originated as a classic piece of Orientalist fantasy fabricated in the factories of the British Midlands. Its story and the design it depicts stood the test of time, as a New Zealand newspaper article of 1928 claimed. The romance of the two Chinese lovers, which is so quaintly pictured on willow pattern china, has greater worldwide interest attached to this design than to any other that has been evolved during the ages. End quote. In America, John Haddad has traced the popularity of willow pattern weir from the 1780s to the 1920s, including the startling discovery that even several prominent, well-educated Americans actually believed the willow pattern weir depicted the reality of China, as illustrated by the opinion of Carter Harrison in 1889, and I'll quote it to you here. Men's opinions are moulded, or at least coloured, by the various trifle, coloured, that is, into prejudices, which require time and care to eradicate. He whose mother's treasured porcelain service was of the old blue willow pattern has, more or less, his impressions of the celestial empire fashioned upon the model he studied, upon the plates from which he ate. End quote. Why did it appeal? What was the secret of the willow pattern design? Well, first of all, middle and lower class Americans enjoyed its anti-elitism, claims Haddad, while women appreciate the female protagonist's avoidance of having to fulfill the marital wishes of her father. Along with depictions of Asiatic pheasants on plates, in New Zealand, the willow pattern design is, I quote, probably the most commonly recorded pattern from archaeological sites around the country. This is according to an archaeological report on this phenomenon. Pottery shards of blue and white ware found in southern New Zealand indicate its use right from the first periods of contact between European whalers and Māori in the early 19th century. Willow pattern ware made up some of the earliest imports into New Zealand soon after colonisation in 1840. And once regular shipping networks were established, it was sold in New Zealand throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. By and large, most willow pattern ware in New Zealand was produced by British manufacturers rather than in China. And this is indicated in the many archaeological digs around the country, which suggest the popularity of this design lay in part because of its durability, but so too because of its cheapness. It seems to have been a particularly popular item among the labouring classes. It's safe to say then, based on archaeological evidence and extensive reading of reports, newspaper reports and a variety of other evidence, that willow pattern ware was woven into the very fabric of European culture in New Zealand, appearing on wallpaper, curtains and becoming as English as tea, which, like the willow pattern ware itself, was, from the late 19th century, increasingly coming from the British Empire rather than China. Interest in chinoiserie reached new levels in the 1920s in New Zealand thanks to a series of exhibitions of so-called Oriental art that held sway. Biographer E.H. McCormack captured the cult of eclectic Orientalism, as he termed it, which these exhibitions encouraged and which he witnessed while a student at Victoria College in Wellington. Along with salvaged Japanese prints mounted on strips of fabric and hung over black divans and dimly illuminated studio bedsits, McCormack recalled respectable virgins ransacking the Chinese shops in Wellington's red light district for rice bowls and fish plates of approved design. End quote. Other cultural activities in New Zealand also celebrated the willow pattern design. In 1931, Auckland's League of New Zealand Penwomen put on an interesting program of Chinese music. This is the description given it by the newspaper at the time. This included a playlet, The Legend of the Willow Pattern Plate, produced by Mrs. Culford Bell, with incidental music composed and played by Mrs. Robert Neal. End quote. In 1936, the New Zealand Herald asked its readers to render the story of the willow pattern in verse form. They were swamped with responses, so many in fact that they had to carry the poetry finalists over several issues. At no less an event too than New Zealand's Centennial Exhibition, school children performed two plays, one of which was Turtle Dove, a Chinese fantasy. And here is a description of it. The background of the scene was a Chinese garden of the conventional blue willow pattern, the settings being attractively designed, and the players, pupils of Queen Margaret College, were in silken mandarin robes of Chinese blue with contrast of a pale shade, also conventional coolie hats and long pigtails. End quote. A three-dimensional rendering of the willow pattern plate, in this case on stage, was, however, probably not the first to have occurred in New Zealand. In a further complication of the origins and adaptations of a European idea of a Chinese garden, the Wellington newspaper, the Wellington Independent, of 1869 reported on the construction of a tea garden by two Chinese. As they wrote, "Every foot of land has been made over carefully, and a convenient device has been made in the form of an artificial pond in the centre of the ground." End quote. Sadly, no further record can be found of this garden. Tea gardens, like this one developed by our celestial friends, as a report described the two Chinese, while a popular form of entertainment in colonial society, were largely divorced from attitudes towards Chinese people, which by the late 1870s was becoming increasingly hostile and would, of course, culminate in a series of racially exclusionary policies and the kind of rabid anti-Chinese sentiment that was fermented by Richard Seddon's government. In making a three-dimensional representation of the willow pattern plate, the designer of Hawera's Willow Pattern Garden, Englishman Harry Beveridge was mining a deep cultural lode in New Zealand by presenting a design which would have been known to almost all. Another motivation may well have been Beveridge's desire to stamp his own mark on a garden whose previous superintendent had been in charge for over 33 years. The site chosen for the Willow Pattern Garden had already undergone several metamorphoses before Beveridge's design. It was a fernery, then, more recently, a begonia house. But by the 1950s and 1960s, the begonia house was run down and desperately in need of repair. The allure to vandals of so much glass required its constant, near constant, and costly replacement. Indeed, one young troublemaker had the double misfortune to be apprehended by his father, who also happened to be the local policeman. The park's new superintendent, Beveridge, thus used the existing structure of the begonia house as the basis for his willow pattern garden, and I quote here from a description of it. The walled surrounds of the former fernery, and more latterly, begonia house, provided to be ideal for conversion to the traditional willow pattern surrounds, and on designs originated by Mr. Beveridge, concrete blocks were cast to top the walls off, a moon gate was cut, and willow pattern castings were etched on one wall to give the oriental atmosphere. End quote. While site work was in preparation, at night school, Beveridge moulded the oriental figures and then cast them in concrete as the finished product. And I quote here again, "The traditional significance of each figure," added Beveridge, "was acknowledged through its placement in accordance with the legend. Oriental-style bridges, the Cave of Sanctuary, and the escape plan, all surrounded by an ornamental pond representing the sea over which the lovers escaped, completed the scene." End quote. Beveridge also delicately painted the three main characters of the story, placing them on the bridge in flight and pursuit mode respectively. Details from the willow pattern embossed on the garden's inner walls were finished in blue, as you can see here from these images. But what were its origins? What precisely had inspired Beveridge to make this garden? Wistful memories of willow pattern wear from dinners taken on his mother's lap, perhaps? The willow pattern legend seared into his memory from childhood reading of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's Kiramos. The willow pattern that we knew in childhood, with its bright bridge of blue leading to unknown thoroughfares. The solitary man who stares at the white river flowing through its arches, the fantastic trees and the wild perspective of the view. And intermingled among these, the tiles that in our nurseries filled us with wonder and delight, or haunted us in dreams at night. End quote. No, it didn't originate in either Longfellow's poetry or wistful memories of willow pattern wear from dinners taken on his mother's lap. The concept, as Beveridge declared, had its foundation in a floral festival in Oamaru, North Otago, in the South Island. Over the next two decades, the willow pattern garden became a showpiece at King Edward Park, featuring regularly in tourism and parks promotions material. Older residents today recall with pleasure visiting the garden or taking families out on picnics. Its fate, however, followed that of the fernery and begonia house. Just as a mandarin's jewellery had proven too great a temptation to Chang, so did the Chinese figures to local vandals and collectors, and within a few years they had entirely disappeared. Gradually, too, the garden fell into ruin, and by the early 2000s was in a sorry state. But decline has once again stimulated the most recent remaking of the garden. In 2014, Senior Parks Assistant Kane Rangi produced a design combining features of both the fernery and the more recent willow pattern garden. Although this new oriental garden retains a Chinese theme, Rangi's design also returns to the layout of the original fernery, whose floor becomes a sunken path. The new path also snakes around plantings that in the willow pattern garden had formed the island and walkway around the lake. Several motifs from the previous garden remain, and to these Rangi has added a red lattice pergola and Chinese plantings. In a sense, the iconography of the willow pattern design remains now only as a subtle backdrop, a ghost form tracing the general pattern of a former garden. Most visitors under a certain age would probably not recognize the spectral outlines of the willow pattern design, but they would nevertheless acknowledge the general Asian feel it still lends to the garden site today. Recent New Zealand artists have injected new meanings and elements into the willow pattern design, in doing so illustrating the same sense of boundless adaptability and creative energy the design inspired in Britain some 200 years and in Hawera some 50 years ago. In her collages, Kerry Ann Lee, a New Zealander of Chinese descent, uses the basic form of the willow pattern design, but subverts it as a way of challenging, as she puts it, conventional understandings of identity and belonging in New Zealand. As she notes, European occupation of land and their identity making have long dominated New Zealand political and cultural life to the extent of excluding the Chinese presence, who also arrived in the 19th century. Lee uses the colour gold as well as the Chinese bowl and the lantern and motifs that, as I quote, condense distances between a migrant heritage from southern China and the present realities of Chinese New Zealanders, Each of these metaphors embodies aspects of a contemporary Chinese-New Zealand identity, while collectively representing both the boon and burden of settlement, a yearning to retain Chinese culture and customs, as well as forging a comfortable place in Kiwi society. End quote. For example, her work Blue Willow Landscape uses motifs from the willow pattern design painted over a print of a Charles Blomfield landscape by the title of Jackson Peaks, Lake Manapouri, which is a romanticized view of the lake in the southern Alps, very much painted within established European pictorial conventions. Through her collage, Lee reclaims Blomfield's landscape and willow pattern design in order to, as she puts it, announce different cultural understandings of land. End quote. Like Lee, the New Zealand ceramic artist Carol Prentice plays with the willow pattern design, but instead of a contemporary theme, she has given it a uniquely Pacific one, using porcelain as the medium. Inspired by the delight her children took in reciting a spelling exercise, as she says, that took the form of a cheeky love song sung in Māori and English, her Māori willow pattern similarly fuses different but familiar elements. It reinvents, as she notes, in design the traditional Chinese tale of thwarted young lovers who, pursued by outraged relatives, escape to an island in the Pacific, where they establish a home and find happiness underneath the kowhai tree. End quote. These recent manifestations of chinoiserie point to the ongoing appeal and eminent adaptability of a design that in New Zealand has been used for political protest and entertainment as assertions of identity, and not least been represented in three dimensions as a garden. The complexity and cultural fusion expressed by the willow pattern design in New Zealand supports David Porter's observations on the introduction of Chinese gardens into 18th century Britain, namely that, I quote, "The process by which one culture finds meaning in another can rather entail adaptive strategies that are themselves potentially transformative." Thank you very much.